Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the 150th episode of the Calcio Land podcast. And today, the goal of the podcast is to soothe your international break blues. Today, we are going to go over what happened in Serie A over the weekend, answer some of your Twitter questions, name our winners and losers of the Serie A weekend. And this episode is brought to you by our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game, a great place to play various fantasy football games on different leagues, Serie A, Premier League, La Liga, even the Dutch League. And also a place where you can read a lot of interesting articles on Serie A. Today, Chloe Beresford wrote about Fiorentina. You always have John Solano covering Roma and transfers. And I wrote an article this week on the early trends of the Serie A season. So today I'm joined by our great friend, co-host, producer, maker of outstanding videos on Twitter, Alex Goldberg. So, Alex, what I wanted to do is kind of piggyback a little bit on what I wrote for Euro Fantasy Game, the early trends in Serie A. So we have Juve, who've won the first three matches, despite their fans complaining about the poor quality of the style of play. But all the other teams that were pegged as potential contenders for Juventus have already lost the game. So, of course, we had Napoli lost to Sampdoria over the weekend. We had Inter, who had lost their season opener against Sassuolo. We have Roma, who lost against Milan last Friday, and we'll get into that match quite a bit later on. And Lazio, who started their first two matches of the season with a loss. I'm going to throw in Milan as well. They lost against Napoli. They missed their first match because of the tragedy in Genova. So, Alex, out of these teams that have lost the game, which one do you think has the most reason to be concerned so far?
Honestly, David, I'm going to say Roma. I'm going to stick to my guns when I predicted that Roma would actually be the last of the top six in Serie A. And I'm saying Roma because I just feel that Roma right now are two different collections, meaning there's a lot of young players, Cristante, Under, Kluivert, Pellegrini, Patrick Schick. There's a lot of promising youth right there. But then on the complete flip, there's a lot of older players. Edin Dzeko, who's still a really good player. He's 32. De Rossi. I'm not sold on Olsen in net, who's 28 years old. There's Kolarov, who of course was great last year. But to me, it feels like it's either or for Roma. And they have a lot of good players to have a good season. And I do like Eusebio Di Francesco. But with that said, this is a really hard team to manage, in my opinion. I don't necessarily think they have their formation settled on, which is weird because everybody talks about how Eusebio Di Francesco is the 4-3-3 guy. However, that wasn't really what he played over the weekend. And I just feel like there's easy ways to screw up with this Roma squad. I would not be comfortable managing a squad like Roma, even if they have more young talent than some of the other teams you mentioned. I just think it's a little bit of a headache, and it's just not an easy fix. So I like Eusebio Di Francesco, but I honestly think they're destined to be sixth out of the top teams, David. That's my opinion. What about you?
Yeah, I'm not sure they're destined to be sixth quite yet, but I'm with you. I had them right away as the team out of these that has the most reason for concerns for a couple of reasons. I mean, I agree with everything you said. The other thing, too, is we had talked a little bit about the perception of Roma selling Strootman after the transfer window had closed in Italy. And look, I think they did the right thing. They got a good offer. I don't think he was the same player. But that just really is a sour way to start the season. The fans knew they weren't going to be able to reinvest those funds. This was after Alisson and Nainggolan were already sold. So we're already seeing a lot of people in Roma putting a lot of pressure on Palotta, Monchi, even Di Francesco. So certainly I'd say they have the most reason for concern because also their fan base is really pretty intense. A lot of people would say Roma is probably the place with the most pressure to manage in all of Serie A. And the other thing too that would concern me is the defense has really looked like a big liability. Fazio has really struggled so far this season. A lot of people assume, and so did I on Friday, going a three-man defense might help him. He's more comfortable in it. But we saw Milan going right at him So, I agree. I think, too, as you mentioned, the mix of integrating a lot of these young players, Roma's kind of a little bit at a crossroads. I kind of like your analogy. There's half a team of veterans and a lot of new players. So I think they're definitely a team in transition. So I'm with you as the one to be most concerned. Now, the other one that I wanted to ask you is Napoli and Inter. Both you and I were, at least squad-wise, were pretty high on them going into the seasons. Which one of the two do you think has more reason out of concern?
I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment here. So I'm not going to say Napoli because they got spanked by Sampdoria. I'm going to say Napoli more for Inter-related reasons. I think Inter, although they did start off a little bit slow, I think Inter are still going to be second place in Serie A. You saw what Nainggolan did at the weekend. I kind of expected a little bit of a slow start from Inter anyway because they have all of these new parts. But I don't think it'll be that long until they really rev it up. I've talked about ad nauseum how many of their new parts are players that have played in Serie A. So, sure, they stumbled a little bit to start the season, but I think Inter are going to be second place in Serie A. And I'm not overly concerned about Napoli either. I definitely expected them to have some hiccup eventually. I probably am a little hypocritical if I say that I thought they were actually going to get beat like this at the weekend, because I did say on one of the last podcasts that I expected Napoli to actually be pretty strong right out of the gates because everyone's doubting them and because they probably have a chip on their shoulder. But with that said, I don't think you're going to see Napoli have many losses in the near future like they did at the weekend. Sampdoria just played really well. But yeah, I'm a little bit more concerned about Napoli because even though they acquired a Fabian Ruiz and a Simone Verdi, who are good players, I'm still thinking that the loss of Jorginho and Maurizio Sarri is going to hurt them more than the additions of a Fabian Ruiz and a Simone Verdi, even though I think very highly of those two players. Those players might be better in year two at Napoli, maybe, than in year one. So I'm saying I'm a little bit more concerned about Napoli, but not by much, but I'm just really not concerned about Inter that much at all. So, David, that's where I stand.
I'm going to go slightly more Inter. I feel like, granted, that match against Sampdoria was very, very poor from Napoli. We had seen them in the past go down in the score and then make a comeback. They weren't able to even come close to doing it on Sunday. Now, granted, Sampdoria is a very good home team. I expected a good performance from them, not so much. But the thing that stands out to me about Napoli really is their talent is really, really strong. They have a lot of alternatives. You mentioned Verdi starting. We had Diarra starting. So I think Ancelotti is going to try slowly but surely to put a little bit more of his stamp on the team. But if I had to redo our power rankings going into the season, I had Inter second and Napoli third. Despite the loss against Sampdoria, I think I might flip-flop them. I'm a little bit concerned about all the pressure and expectations that are there for Inter. Granted, Napoli has them as well. But I think Inter, so many people, including you and I, had hyped them so much that I could see maybe a little bit more regression based on expectations. So let's see. Definitely, as you mentioned, we don't want to be prisoners of the moment, that there have been some interesting storylines at the beginning of the season in Serie A. So now, speaking of that, let's get into some winners and losers for week three in Serie A. I have quite a few winners. I have a few losers that we'll get to in a second. The first ones are from the Friday game. It feels like almost a century ago, despite the international break. So much has happened. But we had that great performance by Milan against Roma at San Siro. Winners, of course, Higuain didn't score, but that brilliant assist on Cutrone, another winner who came off the bench and scored. I thought Biglia was really, really good for Milan. In a lot of ways, as Biglia goes, so does Milan. We also had Kalanoglu, who showed good chemistry with Higuain. Interestingly, he had missed the first match against Napoli, and he came back, and you could tell a big difference. And even Ricardo Rodriguez, who I haven't been that high on, I thought that was one of his best matches at Milan. Although Roma left that match definitely in far worse shape than they came in, I thought Karsdorp did pretty well. He's been coming back from multiple knee injuries. I think he could be a pretty intriguing player for them. I'm with you. Olsen hasn't given a lot of confidence in a lot of ways, but he did have a pretty good performance against Milan. So we want to give him a shout out. Then we had the big Inter win against Bologna. Nainggolan, we'll get into it with the questions, is the man of the match and scored. So far has lived up to being the savior for Inter. We had Candreva, who scored coming off the bench. Last season, he didn't score at all. He was close to going to Monaco, and the potential deal for Kita Balde stayed anyways. He could be an intriguing player off the bench for Spalletti, but good for him for getting a goal. So a big win for Inter, despite both Icardi and Lautaro Martinez missing the match. On the Juve game against Parma, Mandzukic, second goal of the season, a very good work rate. I'm really not that surprised that Ronaldo has kind of latched on to him. It's kind of doing his dirty work, a good partner for him now. And then also Matuidi with a very important goal. I think he's been very good for Juve. There wasn't that many expectations for him after he arrived from PSG, but he's been a more than solid addition for Juve. For Parma in that same match, we want to give a shout-out to Jorginho, his speed, dribbling ability that we had seen him display at Roma a few years ago. He still has some of that left, and he could be a very important player for Parma. And then, of course, we had the big win for Sampdoria. I want to give a shout out to De Frel, scored two goals. I think that was just as many as he had all of last season for Roma. We had that unbelievable goal from Quagliarella, and look, you know, we know that's how he rolls, likes to make a lot of these unbelievable goals. If you watch it from so many different angles, you just pick up more and more of how awesome that heel shot was. Couple of other shout-outs on Sampdoria. Former Napoli defender Tonelli, who I think would be a very intriguing addition for Sampdoria, was really buried on the bench at Napoli. But for a mid-table team, he's definitely a quality center-back. Also want to give a shout-out to right-back Berezinski. Actually, a really intriguing right-back in Serie A. I could see him at a team like Napoli, maybe next year, if they decide to cash in on his jazz. I could see Berezinski being a very good addition for a club like that. Then we had Torino's win against Spal with a goal by defender Nkolu. That game was delayed a little bit because of rain. A big win for Torino. Spal had won their first two matches. Not a big deal that they lost this one. We want to give a shout-out to their goalkeeper, Gomis, who's been very good this season. And then we had Fiorentina's big win against Udinese, 1-0. Benassi with another goal, third of the season. He's on the national team right now with Mancini, was at the press conference today. He's getting a lot of exposure. Good match for him. Excellent start to the season. Chiesa with a brilliant assist in that match. I tweeted, it really wouldn't surprise me if in the next 2 years Chiesa is the best player on the Azzurri. He might even become that much sooner than that. What a talent. I'm so impressed with him. Then we had Lazio, who really needed a win against Frosinone, Luis Alberto's first goal of the season. He's been struggling. Even Milinkovic-Savic looked a little bit better in this match. We also want to give a shout-out to defender Acerbi, who's off to a good start replacing De Vrij. Definitely a player to watch because that's a big loss for Lazio losing De Vrij. But so far, Acerbi has done pretty well. We also want to give a shout-out to Cagliari midfielder Nicolò Barella. Had the game winner in Bergamo for Cagliari. Very important match for them. Cagliari, you know, last season was in the battle to avoid relegation until the bitter end of the season. These points early in the season count as much as towards the end. So big win for them in Bergamo. And Barella's also with the Italian national team now. Then we had Genoa striker Piatek, who I learned you actually pronounce his name Piontek. Third goal already for Genoa, had four in the Coppa Italia. Really promising player, although they lost to Sassuolo. Definitely a bright spot there. Pandev also on Genoa keeps playing very well. And let's close out on Sassuolo. Definitely a lot of winners. They won that match, scored five goals on Genoa. Boateng, Prince Boateng, has been very good since joining them. They're playing some different roles, first as a false nine, then playing behind the strikers. Shout out to him and to manager De Zerbi, who we've always been high on the podcast. On the flip side, some losers for Roma. We have defender Fazio's really off the disastrous start to the season. Nzonzi, who looked good against Atalanta, gave up the pass that ended up being then the game winner for Milan. Bologna, definitely a team that should be really concerned. They haven't scored any goals in three matches to start the season. They really miss Verdi, who was carrying them last season. I would really be concerned if I was a Bologna fan. Napoli goalkeeper Ospina has given up 5 goals in 2 matches. Granted, we've said for a while that a goalkeeper has been a position of need for Napoli dating back to last season. It doesn't look like it's improved by much. We don't want to go too hard on Atalanta, who were playing in the Europa League. They unfortunately were eliminated on that on Thursday, but then they also lost to Cagliari. So difficult week for them. And the last loser, I have Chievo, who only drew at home against Empoli. I got a chuckle out of the comment in the Gazzetta dello Sport how Chievo was doing this catenaccio at home and succeeded to get a point. I mean, if they have to do that against Empoli at home, a team they are going to be competing for to avoid relegation, that's a problem. So that's our winners and losers for the Serie A weekend. And there's always winners when our listeners send in questions for the podcast. As always, we're looking for questions on Serie A, transfers, Italian football as a whole. We're going to cover the Italian national team in the next few episodes, as well as music, TV, journalism. We've also been getting some really cool questions on podcasting. So if you have questions on those, please send them in. Just remember to use the CalcioLand hashtag, because that's what I search when I put the podcast together. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. What do you make of Serie A's team's chances in the Champions League?
But I'm also curious to hear your take, Alex, because you keep up with the other leagues better than me. So to recap, this is how the draw went. Inter, who was in the fourth pot, so had long odds to have a good group. They didn't. They ended up with Barcelona, Spurs, and PSV. Napoli, and I really enjoyed De Laurentiis' interviews, where today was wondering why Liverpool was in the third pot. So he ends up with Napoli, end up with Liverpool, PSG, and Red Star Belgrade, who are back in the Champions League. Not a very easy group. Roma surely did pretty well. Although they have to face Real Madrid, they got CSK Moscow and then Victoria Plzen. And Juve, I think overall, did pretty well here. They end up with Man United, so Paul Pogba is going to return to Juve Stadium. They face Valencia, and they face Young Boys from Switzerland. So I'll say, and I'm not a huge expert on the other leagues, I think for Juve it could have gone a lot worse. I think if they had to get a PL team, no offense to Man United, that's maybe almost as good as it could have gone. Seeing the situation in Man United, it's a great rivalry, historic from the 90s. When we had the bearded genius on, we talked, there's a lot of parallels between Man United and Juve. So this should be an exciting match. And then, of course, we have Pogba returning to Turin with all the speculation on him actually wanting to return to the club. Valencia, you know, could be fairly tough for Juve. Young Boys from Switzerland, kind of a layup. So I think Juve has, you know, good reason to feel pretty good about the draw. I think with the Ronaldo acquisition, more than anything else, it matters in the Champions League. He'll make sure they feel like they go into the pitch as favorites. Roma, I think, could have been a lot worse. I think they're clearly the second best team in this group. No offense to CSKA and Victoria Plzen. I'll take that leap of faith. Napoli, I think in a lot of ways, they could, Napoli and Inter, for me, they need to take a page out of what Roma did last year when the group that Roma had, we were like, they're never getting out of this group. And then not only did they also won that group. So it's going to be tough. It's going to be intriguing to have Cavani return to Naples. We'll have Salah, Alisson returning to Italy, so that should be pretty intriguing. Not an easy group by any means with Napoli, but having Ancelotti, I think, is going to give them a much more of a European dimension. Inter, you know, granted they were in the fourth pot, pretty tough for them regardless. So Barca, Spurs, PSV, they're going to have a tough time. So let's see how that goes. So, Alex, what was your reaction to the draw? How do you think they did overall?
Well, first of all, of course, we all, when we saw Juve versus Manchester United, that is just, that's going to be absolutely delicious. You don't, I don't need to tell you the storylines, but obviously Ronaldo and Man U and Pogba and Juve. But yeah, I think that group, David, overall, Juve will be just fine. Valencia does not scare me. I know they're, you know, one of the better second tier teams in La Liga. Juve versus Valencia doesn't scare me one bit. And I will agree with you. Roma is definitely the second best team in Group G. Real Madrid, of course, the best, but CSKA Moscow, I can't claim to know a lot about them right now, but I obviously know they lost Alexander Golovin, one of their better players, and I definitely think Roma should be okay in that group. Yeah, Napoli, I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be like De Laurentiis and complain and ask why they got that group. I think Inter got it way worse, and I'll get there in a second. But yeah, Napoli drawing Liverpool and PSG, that's just not easy. PSG, we all know, they are made for the Champions League. That's their one goal right now, is to win the damn Champions League. So that will be interesting. And Liverpool, definitely, I expect them to do well in this competition because they did really damn well last year in it. I assume they have some unfinished business. But yeah, David, lastly, Inter got a dreadful, dreadful group. I don't need to tell you how damn good Barcelona is. I don't need to tell you how good Tottenham is. Tottenham is a very respectable team. And yes, much was made that they didn't make a lot of changes in the summer, but that doesn't mean they don't have a good team. And in fact, Lucas Moura has been very promising for Tottenham, so he's giving them a new dimension. And then PSV, if PSV is the weak team in that group, there's no weak team in that. That's the strongest group I honestly can think of. PSV is a really strong team. They still have their star, who I thought would be gone by now, and Irving Lozano, also known as Chucky Lozano. Inter's going to be in some trouble with that group. I agree with you, though. They probably do need to approach it like Roma did last year. But, David, maybe it'll be a blessing in disguise if Inter bottom out of that group, because maybe they can just pull a Napoli and focus. Maybe they cannot even go to Europa, and they can focus fully on Serie A. That is a devastating group for Inter Milan. So let's move on, David. Next Twitter question. What have been the biggest surprises in Serie A so far this season?
So I'm going to piggyback a little bit because we mentioned them in the winners and losers, but Sassuolo has to be the best story so far in Serie A. They have 7 points. They beat Inter, they beat Genoa, they've been playing really well. I was very high on De Zerbi going into the season. I didn't expect them to be quite this good, also because they lost Acerbi, who was definitely a big loss on defense. So to me, they are the most pleasant surprise. We mentioned Genoa striker Piontek, who's been off to a sensational start to the season. Genoa, once in a while, has a way of discovering these gems outside of Serie A. Spal, we mentioned, they started their first two matches of the season with a win. They almost got a point in Turin against the Granata. So they're a great story. Fiorentina as well. You know, they're the only team with Juve that have won all their matches. And granted, they have one less match because of the tragedy in Genova. They're going to recoup that. They've been playing really well. I have to say, I really enjoyed watching that Fiorentina-Udinese match. I was telling you guys last week that I had heard a lot of good things about Udinese, so I was really focusing on getting a sense on their new manager and what they were all about, but I left really impressed with the way Fiorentina played. And on the flip side, we mentioned them earlier, two teams that should be very concerned with the start of the season are Bologna and Chievo. I really could see these two teams being in the battle to avoid relegation until the bitter end. And these are two clubs that, you know, have a lot of Serie A experience and should be better. So those so far are my biggest surprises. Anything at your end, Alex, that has really stood out to you?
David, not many big surprises for me just yet. I am a little bit surprised that Milinkovic-Savic has started poorly, although I don't think that's going to last very long. And then while we're on Lazio, I think I'm a little surprised that Luis Alberto is legit. He had a great year last year, and it took me by surprise. I think it took many people by surprise, but he was really good at the weekend again, and I expect now another great season from Luis Alberto. So, you know, for a while, I kind of thought, all right, the legit players really are Milinkovic-Savic and Ciro Immobile, but Luis Alberto is making me think that he's right there with the two of them. So, yeah, I guess my surprises so far have come from Lazio. David, next Twitter question. This is a personal one in terms of we have this person's name. Oil King asks, was Napoli's loss proof that they shouldn't bench Hamsik as easily as you suggest? And also, I can't help but notice Locatelli has started twice for Sassuolo.
You guys know I'm never afraid to admit when I'm wrong. I give a lot of takes on here. I don't give them as many on Twitter. I'd rather give them here, but I'll stand behind what I have to say. And look, you know, Ancelotti kind of listened to me. He definitely didn't listen to me. He did it on his own. Bench Diarra. I thought even benching Callejon was maybe even more bold. Those were two really players that you really associated a lot with the way Sarri played. And it didn't pay off. Now, I will say this, in my defense, when we did the game picks, I had pointed out that Sampdoria is a really good home team. I had it as a draw. I kind of regret. I kind of had in the back of my mind, let's see if Sampdoria can win it. So I'm not going to overreact a ton to this Hamsik one. Diarra didn't have a particularly good game in general, though Napoli didn't play well. So I need to see more of that. To me, that is a small sample size, but I want to acknowledge the question. It's very fair. Also, the same listener pointed out that I had put the over-under on Locatelli starts this season at around 18. He started two recent matches, then started the first one. He's played pretty well. I just watched parts of the Sassuolo match. So let's see if that holds on. I'm still going to stick to that over-under of 18 for Locatelli. He's got two now. I hope he proves me wrong because Lord knows the Italian national team needs as much talent as they can. So shout out to that listener. And anytime you guys want to call me out on bad takes, I'll be more than happy to own them.
I've experienced in the last couple of days people digging up tweets of mine and from, you know, a year ago and reminding me of them. Yeah, listeners are not dull. All right, David, next Twitter question. Does Mancini have a valid point when he says Serie A clubs should play Italian players more often?
Yeah, so Mancini had his first big press conference yesterday after all the selections and the players reported at Coverciano, and he's basically saying, look, there's not enough Italian players starting for the top teams in Serie A, pretty much all the teams for that matter. He also pointed out that in other leagues, they're not afraid to play 18, 19-year-olds. And he had selected Pellegri, who used to be on Genoa, is now Monaco. He left a retreat with an injury, and Zaniolo as well, and we'll get to him in a minute. And I think he was doing it more to kind of lead by example and say, hey, you know, I'm going to select these guys to the Azzurri senior squad. If I can do that, you can play them as well. And there was a very interesting stat tweeted by Alciato, the Sky Sport in Italy reporter for the Italian national team, who does a fantastic job covering them. Today, he even tweeted the playlist they use for music on the background of the training. I enjoyed that. So that was a fun tweet. A not-so-fun tweet is where Alciato pointed out that after Italy won the World Cup, so the 2006-2007 season, after three matches, there were 217 Italian players that had started at least one Serie A match. Fast forward to this year, we went from 217 to only 111 starting at least one match. So, yeah, that's a problem. Now, here's my take. You know, I don't know if it's the chicken or the egg. Are they not playing Italian players more because there's not that many good ones? I think there's a lot to do with that. Or is it that the players aren't getting good because they don't play? And that's certainly a factor as well. So this is really an interesting dynamic. The one thing that I'll say that I think could be an interesting trend for a Serie A team is we've seen this summer how much teams make the top teams. So the Juve, the Inters, the clubs like that make from selling homegrown players, and even Milan with Locatelli, because they're pure profits. And they usually sell them on these loans with buyback clauses. Now, granted, Locatelli wasn't, but Mandragora with Juve was. You got to wonder if Serie A clubs are going to start doing this more, like the Inters and the Juve and the Romas and the Milans of the world, and say, hey, you know, this really can help us for financial fair play. We can sell our young players and, you know, hopefully more of the Italian ones, and then insert a buyback clause, and then the club that buys them has also the incentive of playing them, because then they can sell them back with the buyback for a higher amount. So I was thinking of that. Maybe there's a silver lining there. So look, I think Mancini has a very valid point, but again, I'm not so sure if it's because of the lack of quality is there, or there's lack of quality because they're not playing enough.
Okay, fair enough. David, next Twitter question. Was selling Nainggolan the right thing to do for Roma?
I'm going to stick to my guns, yes. And I know the optics were terrible. Roma lost at San Siro against Milan. The next day, Nainggolan makes a start for Inter, was the man of the match, scored. So I guess the optics are terrible. But I go back to the fact that I really think, and we talked a lot about it on the podcast last year, to me, Roma had to start opening a new cycle, kind of blow it up. I think, you know, that team, that core of players had taken the team as far as they could. This was the summer where they could still get a good return on the Strootmans and the Nainggolans of the world. Now, the difference is, you know, Strootman went abroad, Nainggolan didn't go abroad. He went to Inter, and more importantly, he went to Spalletti, a manager that can get a lot out of it. So you have to look at the whole context, and maybe selling him at Inter with Spalletti is the worst case. But in and of itself, I still think it was the right choice. I'd love for Nainggolan to prove me wrong, especially in the Champions League, him doing really well and showing that he's still that player. But I don't blame Roma for doing it. Let's see how it looks, you know, 2 months from now. Let's judge the deal then. But so far, I get why this question is coming. The optics were definitely bad.
And that goal he scored was old Nainggolan for sure. It was pretty boss. And I don't like that word boss, but 2 years ago, I remembered that brace against Inter, and that's the only way I can define it. It was boss from Nainggolan, and hey, if he is at all what he was 2 years ago, then that's great for Inter. David, next Twitter question. Will Di Francesco be more willing to use Zaniolo now that he was selected to Italy's senior squad?
It's a good question, and I don't think there's a connection between the two. But look, any experience for Zaniolo to be on the senior Italian squad's great. And look, you know, what's interesting about Zaniolo is he's played for a lot of the Italy youth teams. I feel like, you know, the Coverciano, where the Italian national team does their retreat, is kind of like, you know, a center where a lot of these players start. Pirlo was going there since a very young age, worked his way up to the top senior squad on the Azzurri, and maybe Zaniolo's starting to do the same, but I don't think Di Francesco has as much as an incentive to play him quite yet. I think Roma does have a lot of alternatives in the midfield. As crazy as it sounds, I almost feel like Di Francesco has more options than Mancini because of some of the foreign intriguing players that he has. So I'm going to say that, you know, there's probably better odds that Zaniolo is going to be playing, maybe make his Italy debut before he does in Serie A. And the other thing that I'll point out is I know a lot of people were tweeting this about the Nainggolan deal and pointing out Santon, who also was bad when he came off the bench for Roma. So a lot of Inter fans, and I get it, you should gloat in this moment. We're pointing out, oh, look at how great Nainggolan and Santon and the deal. This is a home run. But let's not forget Zaniolo. He's in the deal too, and Zaniolo's now on the Italian national team. You know, I'm not one that gets that excited on young players. I haven't seen much of Zaniolo, but he's very highly rated. So when we, you know, when we evaluate the Nainggolan deal, let's just look at Santon, who was really just a throw-in for salary to make it all work for financial fair play and amortization or whatnot. But Zaniolo is a big part of that deal, and maybe he'll be the one that'll make this deal look better for Roma in the long term.
All right. David, next question. Will Gattuso give Caldara a chance to start after Milan's first two tough matches of the season?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think he will. And I think Gattuso did the right thing, not throwing Caldara out at the San Paolo against Napoli, at home against Zecco. Look, Caldara has shown that he can play in big matches. He did it in the Europa League with Atalanta, some big games in Serie A for Atalanta. But this is already a big jump for him going from Atalanta to Milan. There's a lot of pressure, too, because he had literally a cup of coffee for Juve in the U.S. tour, then goes to Milan as part of the deal. So there's a lot of expectations with him. And he's very rarely played in a four-man defense. So I think Gattuso handled it perfectly. It also worked out pretty well for him that they won that match against Roma. Say they had given up a bunch of goals, drew or lost, there would have been a lot of people saying, oh, you should have played Caldara. So I think he played it perfectly so far. And I think Caldara is going to have more confidence as they're being eased in and being set up to succeed.
All right, this is an interesting question. Do Juventini have unrealistic expectations this early in the season?
You know, I have to really laugh at the fact that a lot of the Juventini that constantly mocked Sarri and constantly say, oh, you win the prize for beautiful football, but you got no trophies. And what does it all matter if you play great but don't win? Yada, yada, yada. These are a lot of the same people that are then constantly criticizing Allegri for the fact that, you know, Juve doesn't really take risks in a lot of ways. Maybe don't go all out to get the most out of their offensive potential. But Allegri is basically doing the exact opposite of the things that Juve fans mocked Sarri for. And at the end of the day, we mentioned that at the top of the podcast, all the other top teams in Serie A have already lost the match. Juve won their first three matches. They have yet to get a goal from Ronaldo. Anyone who's followed Allegri knows that his goal is to get the team peaking by the spring, playing their best football by the spring. And look, some people have pointed out, oh, it's not like Juve plays much better in the spring than right now. And I kind of disagree. I felt two of their best performances last year were in the return legs in the Champions League against Spurs in London and the one in Real Madrid against the Santiago Bernabeu against Real Madrid. So look, this is what Allegri does, always starts slow, doesn't want to show a lot of the other managers what he's going to do with his team, integrates new players slow. So I think Juve is going to be just fine, but I do think Juventini probably getting a little bit spoiled. So again, if you made fun of Sarri, I don't think you really get to complain so much about Allegri's style. That's my sense. Well, how do you feel about that, Alex? Do you think they're a little bit unrealistic expectations?
Absolutely. But I also feel like it's once again being prisoners of the moment in terms of, sure, maybe you're not loving the style that Allegri has right now. But first of all, you should know Max Allegri by now. You should know, and I'm saying you in terms of the fans, the Juventini, should know what you just said, David, in terms of Allegri. Really, he's not expecting his best football at the beginning of the season. He's expecting it in the middle at the end when it really, really matters. And he's squeaking out results anyway. And they probably don't like the fact that he's squeaking out results. But hold on. The style of play, whether he is the opposite of Sarri or the same as Sarri, will absolutely get better once Paulo Dybala gets back and integrated and he's starting and once Ronaldo scores. You know it's inevitable. You know it's inevitable that Dybala and Ronaldo will find a chemistry. And when Dybala and Cristiano Ronaldo find a chemistry and you throw in a Douglas Costa and a Bernardeschi, it will get better. It will get better. Just be happy that you have 9 points. Perfect start to the season. Forget about Napoli. They don't have a perfect start to the season. Just be happy with what you have. So, David, staying on Juve, this is a very interesting question. If Juve had paid a significant amount for Mandzukic, would fans say he was worth it after all the big goals he scored?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's from my friend Martin, who's been supporting my work for years. So shout out to him. I think Mandzukic and Allegri, there's a lot of parallels between the two. It's not surprising that two players that Allegri really loves and plays a lot of the times to the chagrin are Juve fans, are Khedira and Mandzukic, the two guys who actually, well, now there's Ronaldo too, who have won Champions Leagues at Juve. And I think with Mandzukic, a lot of the criticism comes from the fact that when he starts, we have players that have a much sexier style. So Douglas Costa or Dybala, usually one of the twos on the bench. Now that Bernardeschi is on fire and Matuidi is playing so well that he's going with a three-man midfield, they're both on the bench. So I think there's a lot of criticism for that. But look at Mandzukic, scored two goals already. I'm not surprised that Ronaldo really likes playing with him because he does a lot of the dirty work. They can switch between center forward and left winger. We saw Mandzukic battling in the midfield. So, yeah, I think Mandzukic gets a bad rap from Juve fans. I will say I had pointed out that in the second half of last season, he didn't look like himself. He kind of seemed like he was running out of gas. But look at the World Cup that he's had. He's off to a great start at Juve. So, yeah, Mandzukic ended up being a fantastic acquisition for Juve. I think they got him for around $18 million or whatnot. Has more than paid back the club for what it is. But look, every time if he plays, it's going to cause Douglas Costa and or Dybala to be on the bench. People are going to complain. But at the end of the day, it's about results. And I think, you know, once Juve gets closer to the Champions League and they have to play multiple matches a week, I think you're going to see a lot of these players get a regular playing time. So let's see what happens then. But I definitely, you know, I won't defend Khedira as much, although Allegri had a very interesting quote on Friday where he said, look, there's a reason Khedira, all his managers in his career have always played him. And look, he's been at clubs like Real Madrid, now Juve, and on Germany, and he's a constant. It's not that he doesn't have competition, yet he still plays. You know, his stats look terrible, but you know me, I'm not big on stats. I have a feeling his positioning and tactical sense are what keeps him out there a lot. But I think Mandzukic has a lot of those same qualities as well.
That's a very good comparison, man. Mandzukic to Allegri, a player to a manager, but I totally get it. They're both versatile and really know the sport quite well. All right, David, well, let's move away kind of from the X's and O's of football and ask you, what is your long-term football-related ambition after all the articles you have written and this podcast?
So, yeah, it's an interesting question. And look, you know, those that have been following or, you know, listening to the podcast for a while know for me this is – it all started as a hobby, writing about football. You know, I grew up in Italy, loved calcio, had a huge passion on this. I used to write on these message boards a lot. And the guy that ran the message board was like, why don't you write an article for the site? And from there, you know, it kind of slowly but surely went from being a hobby to being a second gig. It's become a, you know, fairly good second gig, keeps me very busy. But I kind of see it as that, you know, my day job's in finance. I work quite a few hours in that. You know, I like to stay busy. I also, you know, like to travel, like to go to concerts, which we'll get to, go on trips. So, you know, I like to have a pretty nice lifestyle, and the day job allows for that. And everything that comes from the football is gravy. But I will say that, you know, my goals is, you know, I try not to compare myself to other people. I just try to be better every day than I was the day before. For me, I want to get better at podcasting. I love getting feedback and suggestions from our listeners. We try to incorporate them as much as possible. I want to become a better writer. The Athletic, I did my fifth article for them last Friday. I'm working on another one that's really challenging because I have excellent editors that are getting a lot out of me. So what I really look at is I just want to get better. Whatever happens out of it, great. I love being an ambassador for Serie A. You know, one thing that I love doing is getting feedback from Premier League fans and fans of other leagues that listen to our podcast for transfers and then got hooked on Serie A. So that's really my goal. You know, anything that comes out of it, great. But I see it as a fun hobby. And speaking of that, Alex, that same listener wanted to ask, what are your goals? You know, you've been doing a great job on the podcast. Your videos are going absolutely viral. I met up with our friend Matteo Bonetti on Saturday. We talked a lot about your videos. So impressed with that. You've been doing great. I know you've been doing more podcasts on the side. So what are your goals, Alex? You trying to make this into a career? What would you like to get out of it?
Yeah, it's funny. I've honestly never thought about it too extensively, especially since maybe you could say the success of these videos back in June. Like I said, that I said on the previous episode, I expected nothing from that first video, but I got to the point where every video someone said, please do a YouTube channel, please do a YouTube channel. And I made it very clear that I'm not really tech savvy. I went to broadcasting school, but I learned what I needed to know for podcasting. I never really dove into the TV stuff because, believe it or not, whether you watch my videos and believe me or not, I'm way more comfortable behind a mic in a podcast than I am in front of a camera. But nonetheless, it got to the point where I have decided I will do a YouTube channel. I'm not really doing anything different. I'll be doing short videos like I have been doing, minimum video editing. I don't need it to all be sparkly and glitz and glamour. It's going to be pretty authentic and pretty much what I've been doing on Twitter. I've been lucky to, in just a handful of months, really build up a much bigger following. So I would say that just want to keep doing what I'm doing because I can't forecast what's going to happen tomorrow or a month from now. I'm absolutely loving Calcio Land, and you know, Calcio Land just keeps growing. And as you say, it's so great that Premier League fans are now listening to pure Calcio Land, not transfer stuff, pure Calcio Land, and they're getting into Serie A. David, I didn't even tell you this, but I had someone say, Alex, I'm listening to Serie A, I'm watching Serie A now, who should I pick as a team? And you know, I said, follow whoever you want to. I can't tell you to like this team versus that, but legitimate Premier League fans are asking, all right, who should my Serie A team be? So I love that kind of these worlds are being converged. So yeah, I just want to keep doing what we're doing because it's just so much fun, and be grateful of maybe what I've built in the last handful of months, but really just take it one day at a time, I guess, is the best thing I could say. So David, last Twitter question. We definitely are moving away from football now. How was Pearl Jam's first night at Fenway?
So I went Sunday night, so you're going to get my review today. Alex, you're coming with me tonight, so you'll be giving the review of the second one. So I went with my wife on Sunday. This was my second time taking her to Fenway to see Pearl Jam. I had seen them before. So long and short of it, it was awesome. I really think Pearl Jam is probably the best live band on the planet right now. There are, so, you know, Foo Fighters are great live. Radiohead are amazing live. There are other artists there. But for me, Pearl Jam really is the gold standard for live bands. And I'm not even a huge fan of their albums. As a matter of fact, I think they have maybe three really great records, two pretty good records, and the rest I'm kind of eh. Some good songs here and there, but they put on amazing shows. A couple of things. Show started a little bit late. Pearl Jam usually plays 3 hours. There's a hard curfew at Fenway Park in Boston at 10:30. They had to cut off 5 songs off the playlist. Never great, but that was still a great show. They did an awesome tribute to Tom Petty. Eddie Vedder actually had one of Tom Petty's guitars that Tom Petty gave him as a gift before he died, and he played it at the show, did a Tom Petty song that was really moving. Their lead guitar player, Mike McCready, like, I've always been a big fan of his, but he absolutely blew me away. I've been going to live shows for many, many, many years, and that was almost as good a performance from a lead guitarist I have seen probably ever. I felt like I was watching John Frusciante in his prime with a Red Hot Chili Peppers. Had a pretty interesting set list. Pearl Jam changed it up every show. That was more of a rocking show. I think tonight you and I, Alex, are going to get a little bit more of a mellow show, but we'll see. I always judge my Pearl Jam shows to the amount of times I have tears of joy during the show. My wife counted 7 times, which for me, that is pretty good. Hopefully I got that out of my system before you come tonight, but those I usually get really emotional at those shows. So that's the show, and on the next show, we'll get Alex's review. So I want to thank all our listeners that sent in questions using the CalcioLand hashtag. We're going to do some more podcasts during the international break. Keep them coming. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Italian national team. We're going to get into all the salaries in Serie A. Gazzetta dello Sport yesterday published all the salaries, so we'll get into that as well. So if you want to send us a question, use the CalcioLand hashtag. Please support the podcast. We love seeing tweets on so your followers can hear about what we do. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, if it takes literally 5 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. You want to leave a comment, we read them all, and we appreciate it. And we're going to close the show with our rant from our great producer, co-host, Alex Goldberg. So the floor is yours.
All right. I appreciate that, David. My little short segment is not going to be about a football player or a team specifically. It's going to be about the difference between critique and hate. And I will give you an example of why I'm bringing this up. But I think this happens to many people who are probably listening. Now, the platform I'm referring to is me talking about footballers on Twitter, but this could be happening anywhere. If you're a Reddit guy, if you just talk to your friends about players, about teams, this may apply to you. Lately, I have been complaining and talking about on Twitter about how David Luiz is not up to snuff as a center back. I have said many times, I like David Luiz as a person. I think he's a funny guy, he's got a lot of leadership, and he's a good guy to have in the dressing room. However, I have constantly pointed out the mistakes he's been making lately. Now, of course, Twitter's a toxic platform, so I don't expect normal answers. But way too often do people disguise or interpret, misinterpret, critique as hate. And here's the difference in my opinion. When I say David Luiz is not an effective defender in a back four, in a two center back system, and I give some reasons as to why, that is critique. If I say something like, David Luiz, I hate and I wish the worst things upon him and he's a smelly butthole, well then, guess what? That is hate. There's a huge difference between critique and hate. Now, if you think I or someone else is talking way too much about one player making mistakes, well then I would call that obsessed critique, which is probably what I do for David Luiz. It's probably what I do for Willian. And I'm sure you listening, if you're talking about your own team, a Napoli, a Juventus, whoever it is, I'm sure you may have a player that you just seem to harp on a lot. But as long as you're not throwing personal cheap low blows or name calling, you're not hating. You are not hating. You are just critiquing. Now, maybe it's not constructive criticism, but it is critique. So if you are listening and you think you are a little sensitive when someone criticizes maybe a player you like and you say, stop hating, it is not hate. It is not hate until it really becomes hateful. That is really important for me to say. Now, I don't necessarily need all the people who told me to stop hating to listen to this and change, but I think this is very useful for you to be able to go on your platform and talk about your team however you want to talk about your team, as long as it's respectful. Because guess what? And I'll leave you with this. Fans, one of the major roles fans have, one of the only roles besides loving and backing their club, which is most important, is to talk about their club. If they want a player out, that's not because they want that player to do poorly or they wish terrible things upon that player. It's because they love their team and they're always thinking of ways for their team to improve. And guess what? If the players switch positions with us, the fans, they would do the same damn thing. So stop, people. If you are one of them, stop misinterpreting critique for hate.